Good morning, afternoon, or evening, everyone. This is Julie McCarty, Knowledge Management Specialist with the USAID Bureau for Food Security. And you won't hear me speaking much today, except during the Q&A portion later. I will be helping facilitate today, so you'll see my name in the chat box. So if you couldn't hear me before, hopefully you can hear me now. We're about to get started with our webinar on the Feed the Future Indicator Redesign. Very quickly, I can see that everyone is using the chat box to communicate. That's excellent. That's how you can ask your questions today and communicate with your fellow participants and the presenters. In addition, on the bottom left of your screen, in that little file share box, you will see a downloadable PDF copy of today's presentation. So feel free to download that. In addition, the Indicator Handbook and the Ag Indicators Guide are linked in that links box on the left. Today's webinar is being recorded, and so we will take that recording and share it with you after this event in case you need to review any portion of it or want to share it with your colleagues. All right, so I'll just quickly introduce our three speakers today and then pass it off to them. We will have Anne Swindale, who is Senior Program Advisor for Monitoring and Evaluation with the USAID Bureau for Food Security. Leslie Perlman, M&E Specialist with the USAID Bureau for Food Security, and Elizabeth Bontrager. All right, I'm working on that one. With the USAID Bureau for Global Health, a nutrition advisor. So our three speakers are on hand today in our webinar control room in Washington, D.C., and I will pass it over to Leslie.
For that. Oh, good. I'm glad you can hear me. I told you I was louder. So I want to welcome you all to the Foreign Assistance Indicator Redesign webinar covering the Feed the Future indicators. I'm going to get moving since we have a lot to cover and we're already a bit delayed. So as you can see in the agenda, we're first going to go over an overview of the indicator redesign and then follow that up with a discussion of the new FTF indicators, the changed FTF indicators, the archived or deleted indicators, and then the reporting schedule for the new or changed indicators. And the last piece will be a Q&A period to answer any burning questions that you may have, which I'm sure you will. Okay, so the indicator redesign was really guided by the following principles. It was focused on data use, and so the process was driven by, you know, what indicators and what data is used for policy development, strategic planning, and external reporting. You know, we looked at the data that were collected and the data that were really used to guide these processes. And we're also focused on improved data quality. So all standard foreign assistance indicators are now classified as required as applicable, meaning if they pertain to your mission level objectives, IAMS will need to collect and report on them. And this is aimed to improve the consistency and completeness of reporting across the FTF indicator structure. Additionally, more flexibility was built in. So in addition to the annual indicators, which we have before, there are now milestone and multi-year indicators. And also, custom indicators are encouraged to better tell the stories at the mission, project, and mechanism level. So F, the Department of Foreign Assistance, in collaboration with USAID and State, began working on this indicator redesign last summer, so it's been quite a long process. We established 14 working groups in sector thematic areas, so it covers not just FTF, but the entire framework of foreign assistance indicators. But for this webinar, we're just going to be covering the FTF indicators here. In addition, there are some new SPSD categories for indicators. So for FTF, you will now see EG.3 for agriculture and HL.9 for nutrition. And this is reflected not just in these SPSD areas, but we have new indicator numbering for all our indicators. And we also ended up with a reduction in the total number of indicators, which we are a little bit happy about. So hopefully that will make it a bit easier. Okay, Anne, do you want to take over the next bit?
Sure.
Okay, good morning, afternoon, and evening, everybody. I do hope that you're able to hear me, and it looks like you can. So as Leslie just mentioned, the Feed the Future indicators still do reflect to the major program areas under S, Standardized Program Structure and Definitions, or SPSD, nutrition, which was 3.1.9 funding, and agriculture, or 4.5 funding, including nutrition-sensitive agriculture. And we still will use the Feed the Future Monitoring System, our beloved FDFMS, as our first-line data collection mechanism for these indicators. What has changed is what indicators are reported where. Previously, all indicators reported in FDFMS were also required to be reported in the PPR. However, now the FDF indicators are divided into two groups, those that are reported only in FDFMS and those that are reported in FDFMS and the PPR database, otherwise known as Next Generation Facts Info. All of our zone of influence population-based survey indicators and all of our national and regional level indicators, for example, agricultural gross domestic product or intra-regional trade, are now only required to be reported in FDFMS. This isn't to say that an operating unit can't include these indicators in the PPR. In fact, when the FY16 PPR is submitted, operating units are going to be asked to select a set of standard and custom indicators, which they will use to report progress under their country or regional development and cooperation strategy. And if an operating unit feels that a Feed the Future Zone of Influence population-based survey indicator or a national or regional indicator is a key indicator that it would like to use to demonstrate progress under their CDCS or RCDS, you can certainly include it as a custom indicator in the PPR, but we here for Feed the Future and BFS are not going to be requiring that those data are entered into Facts Info anymore. The ZOI and national regional indicators are still categorized as required as applicable or optional, or although optional used to be what we called standard, but we changed it to optional because F calls all indicators standard, so it was introducing a little bit of confusion. The annual mechanism level indicators, activity level indicators, are still required to be reported in the FDFMS and in the PPR. And you can still export a PPR report from FDFMS that sums data across implementing mechanisms to get operating unit totals, which can then be entered into the PPR. After the operating unit adds in any additional results that might have been achieved by activities funded by other funding streams, for example, global climate change, and adjusting the OU totals to account for any double counting of beneficiaries across implementing mechanisms, if that is possible. We understand it may not always be possible. And this is very, very important. All of the annual implementing mechanism level indicators are now required as applicable. I repeat, all of the IM level indicators are now required as applicable. The Bureau for Food Security will assign these indicators to every Feed the Future operating unit, and they will be pre-populated into Facts Info. If a Feed the Future implementing level indicator is not applicable to an operating unit's programming because the OU has no activities that would contribute results to the indicator, then the operating unit can opt out of reporting on it with a short written justification in Facts Info. Also reported in FDFMS and the PPR, if selected, are three cross-linked optional indicators, which reflect activities and results under social assistance, private sector opportunity, and climate change and adaptation program areas in the SPSD. And we'll be describing these indicators briefly later in the presentation. So here you can see a summary of the types and numbers of FDF indicators in our revised handbook. We have a total of 49 direct Feed the Future, or 52 when you include the cross-linked indicators. So there's still quite a few. We've got a big story that we're trying to tell, but we have, believe it or not, streamlined them to a certain extent. And so now I'll hand it back over to Leslie.
Thank you, Anne. Okay, so we're now going to go over all the new indicators.
just so you can hear a brief description about what they are. And we'll pay particular special attention to the nutrition indicators, as they are new, or all of them are new. Okay, so here's the list of all the new FTF indicators through this indicator redesign. I'm not going to leave them all here, but since you can download this presentation at a later time, you know, you'll have them to list or have them to look at. Okay, so the first one is EG3-1, and this is number of households benefiting directly from USG assistance under Feed the Future. This is a combination of two previous indicators we had, which was the number of rural households and number of vulnerable households. As both of these before were optional, and you could report on them if you chose, now that we have one indicator, and as Anne mentioned, it's required as applicable, we can actually get a count of the household reach of FTF across the whole initiative, which we hope will lead to more, you know, consistent data reporting. Please note that the disaggregations for this are both duration, so households new or continuing if they were being served in the previous year, and the disaggregation of location, which is split into rural and urban slash peri-urban. Again, this is an indicator at the IM level, so at the implementing mechanism level. Please note there is a potential for double counting in this indicator. This can be collected, say, through number of farmers applying, but for instance, if both a man and a woman from one household are counted under number of, or both counted under the farmers applying indicator, you need to be careful only to report one household. Likewise, if a farmer is trained and counted under the short-term training indicator, and then that farmer is also counted under the farmers applying indicator, that household should also be only counted once. So you just want to have a look at where this data is coming from. Okay, and now off to Anne again.
Thank you, Anne. It's not exactly hot potato that we're playing, but we just didn't want to bore you with the same voice all the time. So our next new indicator, the percentage of female direct beneficiaries of USG nutrition-sensitive agriculture activities consuming a diet of minimum diversity, that is a very long title, is obviously an indicator for nutrition-sensitive activities, which are agriculture activities with explicit nutrition-related objectives and outcomes, for example, an objective to improve diet diversity. This indicator is designed to capture a result that can be achieved through any or all of the three agriculture to nutrition pathways, the production, own production to consumption pathway, the income to consumption pathway, or the women's empowerment to consumption pathways. In the indicator reference sheet in the handbook, you can find a link to more information on these agriculture to nutrition pathways, which are really important programming tools for people to use if you're not aware of them already. This contrasts with the nutrient-rich value chain indicator that was introduced last year, which actually only reflects the production-to-consumption pathway. So we actually are really excited about this new indicator because, as I said, we do feel that it allows a much larger range of nutrition-sensitive activities using different kinds of approaches to achieve important nutrition outcomes to be able to report successes of their activities. Now, a diet of minimum diversity is defined as having consumed 5 of 10 specific food groups, which are defined in the indicator reference sheet, the previous day. And consumption of 5 of these 10 food groups has been validated through extensive research to be a legitimate proxy for the likelihood that a woman is consuming a more micronutrient adequate diet. In other words, if a woman consumes 5 of these 10 food groups the previous day, there's a higher likelihood that her diet is adequate in important key micronutrients. Research undertaken by the Spring Project on how to collect data for the nutrient-rich value chain commodity indicator found that many implementing partners were actually already collecting data on diet diversity for beneficiaries, so we felt comfortable adding this indicator, which captures such an important outcome for in a number of ways to the list of required as applicable indicator. The definition of direct beneficiary under the indicator, because it's female direct beneficiaries, is basically the same as our definition of direct beneficiary overall under the initiatives for now, which means it's somebody who has direct contact with significant interventions, in this case agriculture-related interventions such as training, technical assistance, facilitation of input access, and not just that a woman passed by and briefly observed and attended a meeting or observed a farmer field day and didn't receive any other real focused support. And I don't think any implementing partner or operating unit would want to be held accountable for changing the diet diversity of a woman who just came once, observed a meeting, and left, or for tracking that person down. The new implementing mechanism level indicator is complemented by a new zone of influence population-based survey level nutrition indicator, which measures the prevalence of women of reproductive age overall in the zone of influence who are consuming this minimum diet diversity. After the 2017 interim ZOI surveys, we are going to replace the current women's dietary diversity score indicator with this minimum dietary diversity indicator. And the advantage of this new indicator is it actually allows us to compute a prevalence, to say what percent of women in our zones of influence are consuming this minimum diet of minimum diversity, as opposed to simply saying, on average, women are consuming 3.2 food groups, which is what we're able to say with the current women's dietary diversity score. And now the hot potato will be passed over to Elizabeth, who will walk you through the remainder of the really new and exciting nutrition indicators that are being introduced.
Thank you, Anne, and hello, everyone. I would like to start with a quick note to say that these nutrition indicators that you'll see today were revised or developed in parallel with the development of an M&E plan for the multi-sectoral nutrition strategy with a working group. So the first indicator that you see on your screen that may look familiar from its title, the number of children under 5 reached by USG-supported nutrition programs. But you will see a couple of changes in terms of disaggregation by intervention. This new indicator is an improvement on the previous PPR indicator that measured the number of children under 5 reached. The previous version counted the number of contacts rather than the number of individual children, and it did not disaggregate by intervention. In this case, children are counted as reached through interventions that target them as individuals, and in the case of the behavior change disaggregate, those that target adults such as mothers and caregivers. However, we do not count exposure to mass media BCC because the evidence suggests that this is not enough to change behavior alone. And children should not be counted as reached during pregnancy. You will see that we have a separate PPR indicator that enumerates the number of pregnant women reached. The most important and perhaps the most difficult part of this indicator is the disaggregation. The level of detail that we're asking you for will allow USAID to determine where its resources are going and the priority interventions that we are using to address undernutrition and to reduce child mortality. We want to think of this indicator first in terms of the whole, that is, like the old indicator, how many total children were reached. With the old version, you also had to include a variety of interventions and activities, and you had to avoid double counting of the same children or through different implementing partners. With this new version, we want to know not only how many children were reached, but also what did you reach them with. Therefore, we're asking you to report the numbers of children reached by these individual interventions. Double counting across disaggregates is fine and to be expected. For example, one child may have received both vitamin A supplementation and BCC activities. Where it's to be avoided, however, is in the overall total number reached. Partners can double count within an intervention, but then must eliminate the double counting across interventions. If projects providing nutrition interventions overlap geographically, then the mission will need to estimate the overlap and eliminate the double counting. The second of the new indicators is the number of children under 2 who are reached with community-level nutrition interventions through USG-supported programs. This is the first of 2 indicators that are intended to measure to capture the 1,000 days period from pregnancy to age 2. Community-level nutrition interventions involve multiple repeated contacts, SBCC or maternal infant young child nutrition practices, and links to preventive and curative health and nutrition services. They may also include WASH, provision of specialized food products, and promotion of home gardens. We do not want you to count population-level campaigns such as vitamin A distribution, as these are captured under the under 5s indicator, and we want to capture more intense community-level activities through this indicator. And just to note, there's no concern about double counting between this indicator and the previous one, since the objectives of the two are different and they will never be aggregated or considered to reflect the same thing. HL9.3 is the number of pregnant women reached through nutrition interventions through USG-supported programs, and this is the second of 2 indicators to measure the 1,000 days period. Much like the children under 5 indicator, for this one, we're also asking you to report, first, how many children were reached by nutrition programs total, and B, what kind of programs were received through the disaggregates included here. We want you to report the number of women reached by each individual intervention, and then to eliminate double counting of these participants through the same methods that I discussed earlier. We're also asking you in this case to disaggregate by age of women, whether under 19 or over, coming out of some evidence that about the relationship between nutrition and family planning and adolescent pregnancy. HL 9.4, number of individuals receiving nutrition-related professional training through USG-supported programs. This indicator is replacing the former one that you may remember, the number of people trained in health and nutrition. And this one is substantially different. It's intended to capture the capacity-building component of the nutrition strategy and to highlight USAID's efforts to create a more sustainable human resource system in nutrition in our priority countries. This indicator is intended to capture health professionals, primary health care workers, community health workers, volunteers, policymakers, researchers, students, and non-health personnel who receive training in nutrition. This indicator does not include direct community-level beneficiaries, such as mothers receiving counseling on maternal, infant, and young child nutrition. And finally, HL 9.5, a national multi-sectoral nutrition plan or policy is in place that includes responding to emergency nutrition needs. This indicator is intended to reflect the nutrition strategy's goal of increasing multi-sectoral programming and coordination. One piece of these efforts may include a national multi-sectoral nutrition plan, and specifically we're interested in capturing those that also acknowledge the need for emergency nutrition capacity. This plan should be a written document that has been officially endorsed by the government, including commitments from relevant line ministries, and should include the 4 criteria that are outlined on the slide: promotion of infant and young child feeding, detection and management of acute malnutrition, vitamin A supplementation and measles vaccination, and access to safe water and sanitation and hygiene practices. This will be a binary indicator in which missions will indicate yes for every year in which the plan is valid, and no in years in which no valid plan is in place. Now I'm handing it back to Leslie.
Thank you, Elizabeth. I also want to say that Elizabeth is going to have to jump out of the webinar early, so if you do have pertinent questions related to these health and nutrition indicators, please put them in the chat box as you can. I also want to know, I saw a couple of questions. We do, yes, indeed, have a new indicator handbook. We are very excited, as we do get about these things. It is on the Feed the Future website and AgriLinks, so it covers these changes. Okay, so now we're going to go over quickly the changes to these IM level indicators.
Okay, so some have bigger changes, which we will discuss here. We'll discuss each of those indicators. Other have minor changes that won't affect data collection or analysis or comparability. So, I mean, for instance, we standardize the use of, as a result of USG assistance, putting that as the suffix for output indicators, and with USG assistance as the suffix for outcome indicators. Just as a way of really, because with output indicators, you know, we consider that the USG does have more direct control, while with outcome indicators, we look more towards our contribution. I also listed here, we have the program areas and elements under the new FPSD structure. So this is the structure under which we're working now. There are also some other minor changes in the title or definitions to clarify meaning. And you can all find these in Appendix 2 in the new handbook. So like every change that we put in there is in that appendix, so you will be able to look and see. We were trying to be very mindful of data collection burden as well as comparability throughout the whole process. Okay, so now we're going to go back to Anne to discuss the list of indicators with major changes. We're going to split that up. So
I was absolutely delighted to see how many people are absolutely interested in this indicator, because probably everybody on the webinar is my absolute favorite indicator. And to make it more useful as favorite indicator, we added a new data point to gross margin.
You're good.
It got better.
It's better? Okay. So we've added a new data point to gross margin, which is the number of direct beneficiaries of the value chain disaggregated by sex. You'll recall right now you're required to enter 5 data points for the gross margin indicator, the total production, value of sales, volume of sales, purchased input costs, and units of production, hectares, number of animals, et cetera. And we find these data points to be extremely useful for a number of different kinds of analyses. But one real sticking point, especially when we're looking at gender, was not having and not knowing how many beneficiaries were benefiting under these activities, and especially the disaggregation by sex. You do already report the number of beneficiaries of value chain activities under the incremental sales indicators, but we don't have a one-to-one correspondence between the commodities that are reported under incremental sales and those that are reported under gross margin. So because we had this disconnect, we needed to include this data point under gross margin rather than simply adding a sex disaggregate to the incremental sales data point. We've received a number of questions about how to count animals in the denominator for gross margin per animal. This is over the past year or so. And so we wanted to provide a clarification for this, that it varies depending on what the value chain is. For live animal and meat value chains, you should be putting as the unit of production the total number of animals in the herd. However, for dairy or milk and egg value chains, you should only be counting the number of animals that were producing the value chain commodity during the reporting year. And then finally, in our indicator reference sheets, we explain how to extrapolate to the total number of beneficiaries, because each of these data points are supposed to reflect the total across all your beneficiaries when data for gross margin indicator is collected through a sample survey. We also received feedback on the number of full-time equivalent jobs created with USG assistance indicator, saying that the definition that said to count the number of FTE employees in the previous month was too limiting. And so we've changed it so that you basically count over the reporting year, the 12 months, what's the total number of FTEs in order to report against this jobs indicator. Next, the number of individuals who've received short-term training. While the definition for this indicator says that there's no minimum length of time required to consider something as training, we did add an option for operating units to align their definition of training under this indicator with the TrainNet definition so that the same results can be reported in both systems. We also added a requirement that the two disaggregates, right now it's disaggregated by type of individual and by sex, be layered rather than reported separately. So that means, for example, now you will report the number of producers that were trained, disaggregated by sex, the number of people from private sector firms trained, disaggregated by sex, etc., rather than simply reporting the number of producers, private sector firms, and then separately the number of males and the number of females. We also made a minor, very minor changes to the long, what used to be called the long-term training indicator, by changing the title to swap out the term long-term training with degree granting. Because if you look at the indicator definition, it specifically restricts reporting under this indicator for people who are being supported to receive degree-granting agriculture and food security training. So we're basically aligning the title with the definition. The second thing is that we added to the types of degrees that are listed, the types of degree-granting degrees, vocational and associate degrees as well. And we do thank Beatrice Pierre from Haiti for input on both of these indicators that I think have helped refine them. We also changed to align better the title in the number of micro, small, and medium enterprises receiving, it used to be loans as a result of USG assistance, but in fact the definition is broad. It includes both cash and in-kind credit and loans, so somebody who received in-kind inputs on credit to be paid back at the end of the season either with cash or in kind can be counted under this indicator, and we felt the term loans might imply that it only had to be cash. So we changed it to make it clearer. We have the same the change to the definition in terms of categorizing the size of microenterprise. It's categorized based on the number of full-time equivalent employees, and so we made the same change to the definition about expanding it from in the last month to in the previous 12 months. And we also, just very minor so that you could see it more easily, included this enterprise size in terms of FTEs in the disaggregate category, just to make it easier for you. And now the hot potato back over to Leslie, and I'll go back to my answering in the chat.
Thank you, Anne. Yes, it's me again. Okay, I'm going to continue going over some of the changed indicators. So EG 3.2-5, the number of public-private partnerships formed as a result of USG assistance. So in the peers, we provided additional explanation for what counts as a public-private partnership under this indicator. We also excluded community groups from the list of private sector partners. Okay, and for EG 3.2-7, the number of technologies or management practices under research, under field testing, or made available for transfer as a result of USG assistance. So we made a couple clarifications in the indicator definition. So it is not required that a technology pass through all three phases to be reported under this indicator. So if your intervention is looking at field testing and then making a technology available for transfer, you can start right at recording under phase two. You don't need to go through phase one. And also we clarified that phase three counts technologies that are able to be transferred to an end user. It does not count the number of technologies that were actually transferred, so if they're able to be transferred. Okay, and so now our favorite indicators. Well, this is my favorite, actually. Maybe not gross margins, but so for EG 3.2-17, and this is number of farmers and others who have applied improved technologies or management practices.
with USG assistance, and EG 3.2-18, number of hectares under improved technologies or management practices with USG assistance. So we added a new disaggregate under these two indicators, and that is the commodity disaggregate. So we can actually are looking to get an idea of how many farmers, how many hectares are working under a specific commodity. Please note for activities that are promoting something like sustainable intensification or similar crop diversification strategies, where it will be really difficult to calculate the area under, you know, if you have like a lot of intercropping going on, and it'll be difficult to calculate the area under specific commodities. You can choose the disaggregates not available category under the commodities disaggregate to alleviate some of that issue. We've also separated out climate mitigation and adaptation into two separate disaggregates. So we have climate mitigation as one disaggregate and climate adaptation as two, which, and these are quite two quite different areas, though were grossly oversimplified by lumping into one, but mitigation, climate mitigation is actually looking at the sequestration of global greenhouse gases, and climate adaptation is looking at those interventions that develop people's ability to adapt to climate change. So the key is really the difference between them. And so finally, we clarified that a technology with multiple benefits can be reported under multiple technology type categories, depending on how and what purpose the activity is promoted to the beneficiary farmers. So for instance, if you have an implementing mechanism that is looking at, you know, working toward climate change adaptation, and as well, you know, using cultural practices to do so, you can put those number of farmers and hectares under both technology types. Okay, so for EG 3.2-20, the number of for-profit, private enterprises, producers' organizations, water users' associations, women's groups, trade and business associations, and community-based organizations that applied improved organization-level technologies or management practices with USG assistance. We did not shorten this title. We added a little bit to it. But we replaced new technologies with improved technologies in both the title and definition. And we also included the term organization level in the title, which matched closer to what the definition was before, which we're really looking at the improved capacity of these organizations. And we dropped the disaggregate of duration for new and continuing. It was just too hard to collect and wasn't all that meaningful. Okay, for the next indicator, EG 3.2-23, the value of targeted agricultural commodities exported with USG assistance. We modified the title slightly, so it's still essentially the same thing. We clarified when a commodity should be counted as exported. What's the actual port of export? and we dropped the destination disaggregate, as that was very hard to collect as well. So thank you for all your feedback for all these indicators. Okay, so those are the major changes that went over that came about during this indicator redesign. So again, those are all found in the new handbook and in the change table in Appendix 2. So finally, I'm just going to briefly go over the cross-linked indicators. So these are cross-linked to other FPSD categories. They are considered optional under Feed the Future. But consider it as far as best practices. So if a implementing mechanism is, collecting results that relate to these, you know, it is recommended, but they are considered optional. So you'll see.
So that you can blame me if it's too soon. Okay, so for the new indicators, most of them, as you can see from this list, of the basically all of the implementing mechanism straight nutrition indicators plus the household benefiting, we would like you to set targets
for these indicators in FY16, in other words, in the year you're about to report on now, you should set targets for this for the next 3 years, 17, 18, and 19, and then start to report against these indicators in FY17. We always welcome and encourage reporting this year if it is possible. So, for example, especially the households benefiting, if you were already reporting on one or the other of the indicators, then we hope that it would be fairly simple for you to transfer the information that was already being collected into those indicators into the new the households benefiting indicator so we can capture it there. The female direct beneficiaries minimum dietary diversity indicator, this one, because we already have at least one nutrition sensitive agriculture indicator, we said that this one can be reported only by new activities. It does not need to be integrated into existing activities, whereas the six indicators above do need to be integrated into existing activities, M&E systems, with reporting to start in FY17. This one, the direct beneficiaries minimum diet diversity, needs to be incorporated only in new activities. They should establish the baseline and targets in 2016 if possible, but we recognize it's the 14th of July, and so it may be a little bit difficult to get that done. But and then to start reporting in 2018 or 2017 if that is possible. And the prevalence of women of reproductive age consuming a diet of minimum diversity, we actually, in our guidance for the 2015 population-based survey interim, asked that missions collect the information on diet diversity in a way that allows the computation of both women's dietary diversity score and this new prevalence of minimum dietary diversity. So the baselines for this indicator basically have already been collected in the 2015 interims, if missions followed our guidance. On the changed indicators, the new disaggregates that Leslie's just described, we will require reporting against them starting next year, FY2017, but certainly encourage and welcome reporting in 2016 if you are able to do so. And then for the remaining ones which have pretty minor changes in their definitions, to start reporting or continue to report against them or start reporting against them in FY2016. In other words, this year. So that's the end, and now we're to a comment, question, and answer time. We've been typing and trying to respond to some of the questions as we went along, but maybe we should just now start trying to answer some of them verbally.
I think that sounds great. Just testing to make sure that my audio is coming through as it was before. Sounding good? All right, good. So we had a couple of questions that I think are kind of more broad and relevant to everyone. FinTrack had just asked, if an implementing partner has one of the dropped indicators, will we still report on it for FY16, or are they eliminated effectively immediately?
No, you'll be able to continue to report on any of the dropped indicators if you have already been reporting against them for an implementing, if you're an implementing mechanism and you have any of these dropped indicators and you're reporting against them, you still report against them in FTFMS through the end of your activity. You don't have to drop them. Well, Leslie? No. Oh, but she had something to add to that.
And then we had a couple of questions about the old peers. Can we get guidance on how best to handle baseline data that was collected using the old peers, where the indicator definition has changed even slightly? And also, what would you advise for a project that has done peers based on former indicators? Can you kind of elaborate on how to deal with that issue?
That is a very good question. Well, we obviously can't go back and change baselines. So I think in these situations, the best thing that we all can do is document as clearly as possible what the changes are. So I'll answer sort of the second part of that question first. With the peers, what I would do in your M&E plan is to edit the existing peers to show how it has changed. You can use our change table that's included in the handbook to be able to document how the indicator that you're reporting on has changed, and then basically make the change moving forward, having documented that there may be a slight disconnect between the way it had been reported previously and the way that the baseline was collected and how you're reporting on it moving forward. I'm trying to think about the changes that we made to identify where it could result really in a significantly different number, and I'm having a hard time thinking of where any change is really that significant, with the exception perhaps of the jobs indicator, because if you had a firm that actually hired people for a period of time that was more than a month previous, then you could have a much greater number of jobs with this change than you had previously. You wouldn't have needed to have collected a baseline for that indicator, but there certainly will be a disconnect in previous year's reporting that is important to capture. And Elizabeth, did you have something you wanted to add or clarify or anything? No. Sometimes across the table people are like making little signals, and so we don't know whether. So I'm not sure. Please let us know if that didn't answer your question. It was a really good one, and we really should have thought that through before the webinar so we had a response prepared.
Didn't mean to pull up those polls. Not sure what happened there. But Anne, I'll put Anne number two to your mic when you're not speaking, because someone mentioned they were having a bit of an echo. And I would just like to call out, there were three different people who asked about the timing of when we needed to start reporting on the updated indicators. There was a slide that Anne presented on the timing, so I just wanted to assume that those have been answered, but if you're still confused about the timing for when to report on the new definitions, please let us know in the chat box. All right. So a lot of good questions come in here. They're coming in rapid fire, so we're looking through them. Let's see. We had a question from Fatou Thiam, who asked if EG11-6 is different from GCC indicator 4.8.2-26. Is that something I'll let Leslie look that one up?
That you can. Okay, so from what I recall, I don't have the GCC indicator 482-26 in front of me, but from what I know about EG11.6, this is actually a combination of two GCC indicators. So if you remember previously, we had a number of people using climate information to improve resilience, and then we also had a number of people using or implementing risk-reducing actions. So these actually two indicators were combined into one. So I think the EG482-26 was one of those. So this is why it wouldn't be comparable to the data before.
One quick clarifying question that just came in. For drop indicators, you said we may keep them for 2016 reporting, but may we drop them for 2016 reporting? All right. I'm getting some shaking heads.
Yeah.
Can you hear me, Adam?
But maybe.
Yeah. Sorry about that. We're making sure Anne has a working microphone.
You're fine. Yeah, you have
okay,
to talk.
Now I'm all right?
Yeah.
Okay, good. I've got Leslie's headset on. So we had a number of shaking heads around the table, and the answer
in answer to that question, whether the indicators that we're dropping at a central level should also be dropped at an individual activity level. And I think all of our instincts shaking our heads was to say, at an individual activity level, the set of indicators that you've defined together are being used to report the performance and to manage your program's activities, to set targets against them, etc. And so I think in principle, you'd want to stay with the set of indicators that you originally defined for your activity. However, if the only reason that a dropped indicator was included in an activity M&E plan was because it was required if applicable for reporting to us, and that the activity itself does not find any utility, or the mission, operating unit, does not find any utility for reporting on that indicator, then I think you can consider dropping it. We certainly allow and have allowed mechanisms to drop indicators over time when they realize that it's really not very useful to them if they weren't required as applicable. So that's a little bit more of a nuanced answer, I think, than, as I said, our original reaction of all shaking our heads saying, no, if you included it to begin with, you need to include it until the end of the activity. Elizabeth, do you have any particular concerns around any of the nutrition indicators? It might be a little bit different there because until we start getting comprehensive reporting on the new indicators, we probably don't want anybody to drop any nutrition, now she's nodding her head, any nutrition indicators they've been reporting on, because then we won't be able to report anything on nutrition at all. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. My thought was that the reporting for nutrition through the PPR will change in FY17, but for this year we'd want to maintain the same indicators that you've been using and that have been required over the last period.
Okay.
All right, thank you very much to the M&E team for that response. We've had just a variety of clarifying questions that have come in, so I'll start with kind of the farthest up or farthest back ones that we received. From Beatrice, for FTE, do we still consider a minimum of 1 month? If yes, how many days for 1 month?
It is considered consecutive days to be considered a job, 20 days if it's a job that you get weekends off, that you work 5 days a week, the person works 5 days a week. And the indicator reference sheet provides the information on how many days, 260, are required in order to be considered a full-time equivalent. So I hope that answers your question, Beatrice. 5 days.
All right. And then Louis Kaga says that their activity emphasizes men, women, and youth, and data is disaggregated that way. However, when entering that data, the FTFMS does not cater for data from the youth. Shouldn't this be part of the system, as the youth play a very important role while implementing some of these activities, especially in developing countries?
Yes. You're absolutely right, Louise. And we actually considered adding a youth disaggregate to many of these indicators, but because we anticipate, again, another review of our indicators as Feed the Future, the first round of Feed the Future concludes, we decided to leave that kind of change until the next round, but I anticipate that certainly for a critical subset of indicators, we will indeed be adding a youth disaggregate, because, as you correctly point out, this is a very, very important focus. We'll also have to have some discussion and solicit some input from people, and if you'd like to provide your input right now, it would be quite welcome. What is the most relevant youth age category to disaggregate by? Don't want to make it too complicated and be disaggregating in 5-year age groups, but there are sort of a range of youth categories. Is it under 35? Is it under 30? Is it under 25? So, but your question is absolutely right, and we definitely thought about that and decided to just leave it until the next round.
Sounds great. Thank you, Anne. Let's see. A few additional questions at the top here. We've been collecting your questions, and we have them in a little side document that we presenters can look at. And so we're sorting through them and figuring out in what order to answer them for you. We'll be answering them for up to about 20 more minutes, so please stick around if you would like.
Okay, you are unmuted now. Okay, in the interest of time, I'll just kind of run through some of the questions. We do have a list here. I don't know if we're going to get through all of them. So we have a question from W. Okello: can we define improved technologies? That's actually kind of a funny question. Our presumption is that the technologies that activities and projects have chosen to promote are an improvement over the existing technologies or practices that farmers are currently using. So in my mind, it's not really up to us to define whether a technology is improved or not. It's not up to M&E. It's really an issue of the design of your activity and the technologies that the activity has chosen to promote need to represent something better than what farmers are already doing. We're not, I'm assuming, not going out and just promoting that farmers continue to do exactly what they have been doing before. So I would say almost by definition, a technology or a management practice or a cultural practice that an activity is promoting, by definition, should be in some form or another an improvement over existing practice by the farmers or by the firm. So please let me know if that didn't answer your question, because it kind of didn't. I'll pass it back to you, but that's our assumption. If you're promoting it, it's improved. And Johannes said WASH indicators are almost not seen except EG 3.218. Do we have any? We do not currently have any WASH-specific indicators. There is a WASH element, and there are indicators associated with that element at the USAID level. So missions can certainly select WASH indicators in their PPR, and they can ask their implementing partners to report on those indicators. That's basically the same thing as we mentioned with the cross-linked. We highlighted 3 cross-linked indicators, but there's an ability to cross-link to any indicator that's relevant for a program that's contained in the F-list, master list of indicators. Within Feed the Future and within agriculture and nutrition-sensitive agriculture, the use of agriculture funds to do WASH programming, that's not something we've been doing a lot yet, but certainly if and as it expands, we will need to be considering what would be either an appropriate, very specific Feed the Future water indicator or this cross-linking to water indicators that already exist to the extent that they're reflective of the kinds of programming we would be doing with our funds. So Abdullah says, I do not see indicator 4.5.2.13 in the new list. Has it been dropped?
That is the number of rural households. Yes, it's been dropped.
So that indicator has been dropped, but basically merged into the new indicator. Of the number of households reached by Feed the Future, and because it has a rural and urban-peri-urban disaggregate, what you formerly were reporting under 4.5.213 number of rural households reached would be reported under the rural disaggregate of the new indicator. Benjamin, good question. Does the revised indicator handbook now include an indicator FTF01? It does not include a performance indicator reference sheet for that indicator, but it does include a description of what that indicator is supposed to report in the introduction to the handbook. It's kind of a funny indicator because it's not an indicator in general that it's not an indicator assigned to implementing partner. It is one an additional piece of information that we ask missions to provide to us. But it's in this kind of funny place of not really being an official Feed the Future indicator, but it is a piece of information that we request. But probably at some point in time, we're going to need to just shift it into being an official Feed the Future indicator and write a whole indicator reference sheet, et cetera. Can these changes be can these changes be communicated to Food for Peace activities by the missions, or will they have to wait for guidance from Food for Peace? That's a good question. Leslie, did you want to answer that?
We have been interacting with Food. Hi, everybody. Sorry, we're on the same headset now, so we're just switching it back and forth. We have been communicating with Food for Peace about these indicators, so they are updating their management system and their handbook, and including these changes.
So there's a question from Luis. For the changed indicators, will it be made compulsory to enter the data because our fiscal year is ending in September, and in order to capture some of these new disaggregates in the M&E system will have to change? It's unfortunate our activity is ending this September, and if your activity is ending this September and you're in a closeout plan, no, you are not going to be required. And I think let me see if I can go back to the timing slide. Right. So when you're talking about the change, I think if you're in the last year of your activity and you're in your closeout plan, we'll give you a buy for incorporating the changes of the indicators into your M&E plan. So no, you do not have to to do that. That's fine.
But we do encourage targets in the new indicators for FY17.
But they're ending.
Okay, then.
So you don't need to set FY17.
Nope, they're done.
Shireen asks, that says that they're a policy-focused program and they understood that an appropriate indicator was being considered. Can I speak to this? We do have an existing policy indicator,
so they're not changed.
Which is still in the list and no changes have been made to it. So it's there were changes made to it
in 2014.
In 2014, when the phases, one of the biggest changes was the phases of policy that policies go through were changed so that the last step or process was actually full and effective implementation as opposed to implementation has begun. But those changes are now a couple of years old, and that's the only policy indicator that we have right now. Oh, big boy. Remind us again how polygamous households should be counted. I'd have to go and pull up that email exchange that we had about that. So a household is considered as a separate household when people are living under a common roof and sharing a common eating pot. So people who live together and eat together are considered a household. And there are nuances with polygamous households in a lot of different cultures, but that is the basic fundamental way of looking at what defines a household is a group of people who sleep together and who eat together. We have examples of households where you've got a number of different wives and the cooking rotates among the wives, and so a different wife will cook every day. That would then be considered a single household, as opposed to each wife cooking separately and feeding her children separately, and then maybe the husband just rotates around the different households. So, Beatrice, you echo the question on public-private partnerships, want to count, and the link with other PPP indicators that we have as cross-cutting indicators. I don't see what the original question was. There is quite a detailed description of want to count in the indicator reference sheet. Can you find, really, the original PPP question to which Beatrice is referring, so I can... Yeah, I don't... I'm sorry, I think we need a little bit more
There's the definition.
Clarification of that, and particularly, is there something that is not clear in the indicator reference sheet that you particularly would like a further clarification on? Kate, when does the FTFMS reporting window open?
Early October.
Early October.
As normal.
We'll be sending out the FTFMS guidance soon, but I don't see any anticipated changes in the timing of at least when it starts. So Benjamin wants to find out for the FTF01 estimated number and percentage of FIFA future beneficiaries holding 5 hectares or less of arable land or equivalent units of livestock. Benjamin wanted to know if a farmer meets the number of cattle criterion but has birds, goats, sheep exceeding the requisite number, does she or he still qualify as a smallholder cattle farmer? Yes. In those situations, I would look at what your value chain is. As you specified here, it's the cattle value chain. And so if he meets the requisite number of cattle, then he's a smallholder cattle farmer under the cattle value chain, and you should report him or her as such. And then Dick says, for polygamous families, can we count houses per wife and the men as just part of those households? Unfortunately, it's not that straightforward, because you could have a wife have a separate dwelling, but everybody cooks and eats together. And in that situation, you would consider them a single household, not a bunch of different households. However, you have the other situation where each wife has her own house and she cooks separately, in which case each of those households would be counted as a separate household. So it's a little more complicated than just counting houses, unfortunately. Abdullah, we have got some new indicators. Do we need to report those for FY16? Are you asking about the new FTF indicators? I'll go back to the reporting for new indicator slides. So none of the new indicators are required to be reported in FY16. We would be delighted if you could, but we do not require that, recognizing that it's a bit hard for people to set up the M&E systems to report on new indicators with 1.5 months before 2.5 months before the end of this fiscal year. Valentine, for the project that was still elaborating their M&E plan, do you advise to change now to the new indicators? Absolutely. I think any opportunity that you have to integrate these sooner rather than later should be taken advantage of. Absolutely. And that, in our little side box where Julie has kindly been cutting and pasting questions seems to be, oh, she just pasted another one, seems to be all that we have, but keep them coming. And if you entered a question earlier in the webinar and it hasn't been answered yet, it's just because we've got so much going on in the chat box, we may have missed it. So please just enter your question again, and that way we can make sure that we get it. So Pascal says, what time programs should modify their tools in accordance with the new modification?
I mean, I would say update their M&E plan in FY2017 with the new indicators.
So I don't know if you heard Leslie through the mic, but she was saying update your M&E plan in FY17 to align with the new indicators you are reporting. I'm not sure if that answers your question, Pascal, but so please type some more if it did not answer it specifically. Kelly asked, do we have any guidance on custom indicators? My office is getting guidance from a mission that we should consider them, but there are two standard indicators that work, and the project will be less than $1 million.
I mean, I'd say how well do the standard indicators cover the results and outcomes?
Yep. So I don't know if you heard Leslie, so the question is, so you say you have two standard indicators that work. If those two standard indicators are sufficient for you to be able to manage your activity and for the mission to be able to be to oversee your activity and you and know whether you are on track to achieve the objectives the activity has set, then you may not need any additional indicators.
She said they're okay, but don't really tell our story.
Well, I often, narratives are really important, and I often talk about the importance of numbers and narratives, but if you don't have any numbers that you feel, or if you feel there may be an indicator that captures a really important number that you'd want to be able to tell in that narrative, then you can consider it. I mean, it looks like your mission is just saying you should consider them, not necessarily requiring that you add custom indicators. So it's a balance. As you say, you're a small program, and so you have to be very parsimonious, I'm sure, in the indicators you select. And it's really up to the question is, do you have what you need quantitatively to both tell your story and really important, because the important role of a custom indicator often is that it is more useful for managing the program because it reflects the very specific types of interventions and approaches the activity is trying to, or the activity is using. So usually when we see custom indicators, or often when we see custom indicators, it's because though they are more useful than the standard indicators for managing the activity and monitoring progress. So that is really what it would come down to me, for me, is if do you feel you have an adequate set of quantitative indicators that allows you to adequately manage your activity and monitor progress towards your objectives. So Ndoro asks, also under EG 3.2.6, smallholder farmers in the majority are not receiving cash, but the bank pays the input supplier who delivers, and the farmers collect from these suppliers. Surely these should qualify.
I'm not sure what 3.2.6 is.
We haven't memorized all of our new indicator numbers yet, so hold on. Is this the value of agricultural and rural loans?
Yes, it's the value of agricultural and rural loans as a result of USG assistance.
And so in this situation, so it's a financial institution providing a cash loan. Who pays the loan back to the bank? Does the farmer pay the loan back to the bank, or does the so provide a little bit of information.
The farmer pays it back.
So the bank gives money to this input supplier, who then provides the inputs to the farmer, and then the farmer pays the value of those inputs back to the bank. That's a little convoluted, but I would think that would qualify. There's not much difference than the bank giving that amount of money to the farmer directly, who uses it to purchase inputs and then pays the cash loan back to the bank. So I think I agree with you that should qualify under the indicator. Add an explanation in your indicator comment box that says that this is what's going on. Just in case there are any questions about that, always be clear and document what you're doing. But I think it's reasonable to consider that a cash loan from a financial institution. So Kate asks for number of farmers and hectares. When will the commodity disaggregate categories be available for FY16 reporting in SPSMS and in FactInfo? Valentine, can please clarify again on who will be considered as trained? Okay, so we haven't changed the basic definition of who should be counted under the short-term training indicator. Our basic definition is that we don't have set any minimum amount of time for training. It's that the person has to have received training under a structured curricula designed to build new skills and capacities, and the training is sufficient so that the person has the capacity to apply what they've been taught after the training. And that means that you don't count people who just attend a farmer field day once to observe something. That's not a structured curricula designed to improve skills and capacity. So that definition has not changed at all. The only thing we did to make it easier for missions who and implementing partner who's pointed out that they also have to report number of people trained into this TrainNet system. And TrainNet does set minimum time. I think it's something like 16 hours if it's non-consecutive, and at least one day if it's all at once, or I don't have it off the top of my head, but they do have minimum amounts of time defined to count as training. And for those missions that are wanted to be able to align the training definition under TrainNet with the training definition under our indicator, we said that was perfectly fine, that they could do that. Abdullah, missing indicator means we do not need to report against that, right?
That's rural households.
Okay, so Abdullah, this is the same rural households reached. This has been integrated into the new households reached by Feed the Future indicator. So if you're already reporting against 45213, you can just switch to the new indicator and report the 45213 result under the rural disaggregate. And Nazrul, no, we haven't changed the incremental sales indicator in this particular round. Yay! Unless you would like it to be changed and have a suggestion of a way you would like to see it be changed. We know it's still kind of a complicated indicator because of the baseline issue and the possibility of the average sales at baseline being from a group that may be a little bit different from the beneficiaries over time subsequently, but right now we don't have any better fix than the fix that we've come up with, and so we haven't made any changes to that. Bekele, are the indicators under 4.5 recategorized under EG3? Yes. We used to report on indicators 4.5.2, which will now be EG3.2.
So yes, they're at least the ones that remain, we have dropped some in the F master indicator list. But yes, there is this whole new numbering that we're all going to have to learn. 3.1.9, which was nutrition, now is HL.9 as well. So yes, we all have to learn new numbering.
Excellent. Thank you, Anne, for running through that long list of questions. And thank you to everyone who attended the webinar today for asking such useful, insightful questions and for sharing with your colleagues. We are officially at the end of our time now, so we're going to go ahead and wrap up. Thank you to those of you who have shared your email in the chat box for the recording. If you were on the original email that received the invitation to this list, if you're on the main FTFMS email list, you will definitely receive the recording and any other resources we put together from this webinar. But if you were passed this along by a colleague and you don't think you're on that original list, do feel free to share your email address in the chat box, and I will collect those and make sure that you get the recording of this webinar. Great, excellent. Lots of emails coming through. Well, thank you very much. I'm going to say thank you to our presenters, Anne, Leslie, and Elizabeth, and also to Kate West for being on hand with some additional information. And especially thank you to our AV Tech, Adam, for helping make sure this goes smoothly, despite a few technical difficulties. It's always tough when we are coordinating multiple presenters and bringing all of you in from around the world. But we want to be able to use Aid Connect as a way to communicate in useful ways. So thank you for allowing us to test it out on all of you. All right, we'll be in touch and have a great rest of the day. Thank you.